So tonight, the meeting title is Can Workers Run Society? And our guest speaker tonight is joining us from Dublin, and it's John Molyneux. And John is editor of the Irish Marxist Review. He's active in the People Before Profit Party in Ireland and is a member of the Social Workers Network. So welcome, John. And John is going to speak for 20 to 25 minutes, and then we'll open it up to discussion. So, John, welcome, and over to you.
Thank you very much, Helen. Hi, everybody. It's really good to be here. It's a pity that I can't go for a walk in the Peak District or check out your crooked spire as I did last time I came. When was that? I think it was 2017 when I came to Chesterfield. But nevertheless, I can now be here without making a donation to the airlines and increasing my carbon footprint. So I suppose that's good. Good things. Anyway, look, I'll start by saying that personally, I have no doubt that if you collected 30 people, more or less at random, 30 ordinary people on the streets of Chesterfield, and made available to them the resources of government and the resources and the expert information and so on, and the expert time, that they would make a much better job of dealing with the COVID crisis than the crew you've got in government at the moment. A much better job. And I think, you know, there's a simple reason for that. It's got nothing to do with expertise, nothing to do with who's a brilliant politician. It's got to do with the fact that they wouldn't be have the same vested interests, the same need to defend profit, and that would lead to them making a number of obviously different decisions. You know, you wouldn't wait till the last possible moment before locking down. You wouldn't put off into and sideline the question of providing PPEs for the health service and masks for ordinary people because there was a glitch in the market. You would take over the private hospitals. You would take over industry, just like they did in a way in the Second World War, regardless of what you think about that, but they did it. They could do it, you know, to build Hurricanes and Spitfires when they needed them. They could have done that to manufacture ventilators, PPEs, masks, and everything else that was needed, but they didn't. And that was entirely because they're vested. So I think ordinary people would have done much better. And it's not just in this situation. I'm going to give an Irish example here. In Ireland, when there was a big debate raging in the society about repealing the Eighth Amendment a few years back, the Eighth Amendment was an amendment to the Irish Constitution that denied women any right to choose on the question of abortion. And for there to be any sort of reasonable legislation, any sort of reasonable regime over abortion, the Eighth Amendment had to be repealed. And all the vested interests on the right of Irish society wanted to stop that, but they got pressurized into calling a citizens' assembly of 100 people. I think the establishment was very convinced they could manipulate this, they could control it, that they would be conservative anyway, and so on. Much to their surprise, these 100 ordinary citizens who listened to expert advice and so on came down with an extremely progressive report, and that report, not perfect, but very progressive, and set the whole scene for a brilliant popular campaign to repeal the Eighth Amendment. So ordinary people, when they had a chance to have their say, were miles better than the establishment. The other thing I think about the present COVID crisis in Britain, in Ireland and everywhere else, is that it shows absolutely clearly who are the essential workers, who it is that counts. I mean, let's face it, the Prime Minister of the UK was out of action for quite a long time. It made a relatively little difference to anything that happened. Might have made a bit of difference to spin, but to actually the substance of the matter, nothing. Again, I'll give an Irish example, though this is in British-controlled Ireland. In the north of Ireland, you have had 3 years without a Stormont executive, 3 years without a government in Northern Ireland. Society hasn't broken down. It hasn't made things any worse. In some ways, it's made things a bit better. It's an illusion that these people really run things, that they're the essential workers. Now imagine a society in which the street cleaners didn't work, or the nurses didn't work for a week. You would have a health crisis. The nurses didn't work for a week. You'd have enormous numbers of deaths. If the street cleaners don't clean the streets and the bin men don't collect the rubbish, you're going to have another kind, different kind of health crisis. Their work is enormously more essential than the government's, or indeed all the celebrities and so on, who all, you know, 100 times as much as them. Now, the question that this meeting is, though, is not just who's the essential workers, but can those people who are the essential workers, who do all the key work in society, and let us remember, produce the wealth that is then appropriated by the Richard Bransons and the Bullingdon Club boys and the Tofts and the millionaires and the billionaires and the giant corporations. Can those people who do all the essential work and produce the wealth, can they actually run society? Now, this is an important question, I think, and it is one which we are deeply conditioned. I'll come back to this later, but we're deeply conditioned to believe the answer to that is no. It is never even considered, is it, in the mainstream, in the media and so on. You'd be mad to even suggest such an idea. What are you talking about? Impossible. Now, having said that, I think it's necessary to say that, unfortunately, and it is unfortunate, one way in which it's not possible for working class people to come to run society is through Parliament. Insofar as the idea of working class people having an influence on how society is run, the official line, if you like, and what we're all educated to and conditioned to, is the idea that you do this through electing people to Parliament, electing your representatives to Parliament. Now, I'm not against this. Much better to elect socialist representatives to Parliament than it is to have Tories and so on. Good. But it is not the case that even if the majority of people in Parliament were socialists or representatives of socialism and of working class people, that workers would actually be in power. Unfortunately, not true, for the simple reason that Parliament is not the real centre of power. It's where the television turns up. They all act as if it is, but the truth is it is not. The truth is that the decisive centres of power in any society, any capitalist society, are outside Parliament. In terms of physical force, they lie with the army and the police. In terms of the economy, they lie with the giant corporations and so on. And also, they lie with a deep state within the bureaucracy and so on, which is not controlled by Parliament. Special branch, MI5, MI6, you name it. And so, consequently, even if you get a socialist majority in Parliament, they do not control the decisive levers of power. The people who do control those decisive levers of power will, I would argue, use them to prevent the socialist majority in Parliament implementing any of the things that would really serve the interests of working class people. Let me put this very concretely. I think that even if Jeremy Corbyn had won the election, and of course, I assume that everybody in this meeting would have ardently hoped that he would, and it would have been a good thing if he had, but even if he had, it is not true that by winning the election he would have been able to do all the good things for working class people that he wanted to do. Far from it. All the forces that actually were able to stop him winning would have ganged up to prevent him doing so. So if it can't be done through Parliament, how can it be done? Now, here I think a bit of history comes in handy. Because there was an occasion, best part of 150 years ago, when working class people did take over and start running society. This was in Paris, in the Paris Commune of 1871. It was only in one city, and it didn't last very long. It lasted 74 days, to be precise, before the French army, backed by the German army, who were all around Paris at the time, for reasons I won't go into now, but backed by them, the French army, acting on behalf of the ruling classes of France, suppressed the Paris Commune, and they did so with enormous bloodshed. They killed something in a week, the Semaine Sanglante, the bloody week. They killed about 30,000 people on the streets of Paris. But for those 74 days, you did have workers' power, workers' control, at least of Paris. And it left a very important legacy of how this can be exercised, how it can be done. It's written out of history, by the way, in terms of mainstream history, but that's the way, of course. But it was written about at the time, very dramatically, very graphically, by one Karl Marx, in one of his greatest works, in my opinion, The Civil War in France. And he made three points about what the workers of Paris had done. And I think they're very important guidelines for how working class people can take political power and really control things in society. The first thing he said was that the Commune proved that it was not possible to take over the existing state apparatus and wield it to serve working class interests, to use it to implement policies that would serve the working class. Now, think about that for a moment. This is Marx in 1871, says, the Commune shows you can't do that. You have to dismantle the existing state and create a new worker state of your own on different foundations. Now, actually, that one sentence, he added it to the Communist Manifesto and so on, but that one sentence really undermines, in a way, the whole strategy of what, if you like, the mainstream social democrats and labor parties of Europe and the world, the strategy they've been pursuing for 150 years. Their strategy everywhere has been, you win an election and that will put you in power and then you will change society. And the fact that it has never worked doesn't deter them. That's still their essential strategy if they want to change society at all. And Marx says, nope, you can't do it. Now, this is not an abstract debate. Think about it. I wonder, when the British Labour Party, but any other Social Democratic Party talks about its programme for government, there's certain things they never mention. Never. They never mention MI5 or MI6 or the special branch. They never mention the deep state. They never mention the armed forces. They never mention who controls the judiciary. They talk about economic policies and social policies, and they talk about getting rid of the Tories or the Christian Democrats, but they never mention these things. But ask yourself, is it realistic to imagine that if you elect socialist MPs and a socialist government, that MI5, MI6, special branch, the judges and the heads of the armed forces will say, oh, well, that's democracy. Right, we all have to go in for socialism now. Or do you think it's more realistic to say, they will say, oh my God, what's happened here? Those stupid people have gone and elected traitors and communists and whatever. We'd better get rid of them. It's our job to make sure that Britain isn't transformed into a communist state or something. I would bet a pound to a penny that they would do the latter, and the idea they wouldn't is a dream. But if, then, Marx is right on that and you need an alternative, and this is then two other principles that he outlined for the Paris, from the Paris Commune, that he drew from the experience of the Paris Commune, extremely important. The second principle was that you should have recallability of representatives. This is tremendously important. In a ordinary parliamentary election, the electorate are atomized. They're people in a constituency, Chesterfield or wherever else it is, And they're not gathered together at any point in between elections. The only point they, in any sense, come together is to cast their vote in the ballot box. So consequently, they can exercise no control over the people they're elected. You elect a government, you elect MPs, they don't do what they said they were going to do very frequently, and there's nothing you can do about it. Marx says you need learning from the communists. The communists did it. You need recallability. And you can get that recallability if you elect delegates from collectives, not from atomized constituencies, from workplace and other community organizations. You elect these delegates to the Chesterfield Assembly or Workers' Council or whatever, whatever you call it, and they elect delegates on from that. You can recall people, crucially important. The third principle that he talked about, and this still exists in the movement to this day to some extent, is that the elected representatives and the state officials should all be paid a worker's wage so that they don't become a privileged layer standing over and above the people who they claim to represent. Now, as I said, it still exists. It doesn't exist in the mainstream, but it does exist, I think, in some sections of the socialist movement. I'm very lucky that in where I live in Dublin, we have a socialist TD, Breed Smith, from People Before Profit, who really. Breed Smith takes an average worker's wage. She doesn't take the 90,000 or 100,000 that they pay. No. You know, she takes an average worker's wage and donates the rest to the cause. And it's a very, very important principle that should apply. And necessary if working class people are going to take control of political power. Now, something immediately has to be added to that, because political power is essential, but it's not enough, because political power has to be complemented by economic power. If you just take political power but leave economic power in the hands of the millionaires and the capitalists and so on, they will subvert everything that you do. You will not really run the society. So you have to find a way of taking economic power as well. And the mechanism for that, I think, is very, very clear. You need two things. You need public ownership. You have to take collective ownership of not every shop, not every corner shop, every chip shop and so on, not every little business, but you have to take collective ownership of the main industries in society and the main services, and you need to run them under workers' control. Both parts of this are essential. Unless you have public ownership, you can't control them at all. And even if you had workers controlling individual enterprise, they'd end up competing with one another and so on. But if you just had public ownership run by the traditional state officials, they would still run as capitalist businesses in the same way that, say, the National Coal Board under Ian McGregor did, some people will remember from here, or many other examples. You have to have workers' control of these things, and workers' control in workplaces. And there you apply the same principle as you do with the workers' councils that I was talking about, the idea from the Paris Commune. You elect a committee or a group to run whatever it is, your school or your hospital, and they're recallable. And you have periodic meetings of the workforce. They can be, you know, in a school, they would be the school students, the teachers, the support staff, and probably some representatives of the parents and the community. Something similar in hospitals, doctors, nurses, support staff, support workers, and so on. And you elect a group of people to run the hospital. And they work in collaboration with the Workers' Council. That's how you do it. Now, I gave the example of the Paris Commune. Paris Commune is not a one-off. Actually, wherever working class people have tried or moved in the direction of taking power, they have created some similar structures to this. The most famous example is the Russian Revolution, where they were called Soviets. Now, the way this has all been treated by historians and in the media and so on, as if Soviet was a peculiarly Russian thing, and the Russians were called the Soviets. Don't misunderstand that. Soviet just meant workers' councils. And Soviet itself literally was the word for council. And in Germany, when there was a German revolution at the end of the First World War, they created their own version of workers' councils. In Ireland, in Limerick, when they took over, they had a Limerick Soviet. They used that term. In Chile, in 1970-73, they called them cordones industriales, industrial belts. I won't go through it because time is short. Many other examples.
Yeah, can I, 5 minutes warning, John.
Thank you very much, Helen. Okay. Thank you. I know I'm running out of time, so I'm going to...
Lots of other examples.
Now, okay. Now, that's how it can be done. First, I want to deal with two things in the last few minutes. One is an argument that it would always be presented against this, but which we shouldn't accept for a minute. That is the argument that working class people don't know enough. They're not clever enough. They don't have the expert knowledge. They're not scientists. They don't have they're not able for it. Now, here is a simple point. You do need to run modern society all sorts of technical and scientific knowledge. There's no question that you do. But don't imagine for one minute that the people who do run our society are scientists, engineers, technical experts, whatever. Or the people who run our giant corporations are. Not a bit of it. The people who run our giant corporations and our governments are experts in something quite different. They are experts in how to exploit people, how to make a profit. Do you think the people who run Big Pharma, for example, you know, I actually checked it, I haven't got time because of running out of time, but I checked this out at one point, you know, who runs GlaxoSmithKline? GlaxoSmithKline is run by the daughter of a lady so-and-so who specialized in classics at Oxford. They're not a pharmaceuticals expert, not at all. They are experts at how to exploit people, make profit. They have working for them and giving them advice all sorts of extremely good scientists. But then there's no reason whatsoever why a workers' government and a workers' council that ran an industry shouldn't also have scientists who work for them and get the information from them and so on. Perfectly possible. So that argument doesn't stand at all. The other argument, and this is in some ways the most important point, is the question of confidence. It's not that working class people are not able to run society. It's that most of the time, most of them don't think they are. And that is an effect of the conditioning that which working class people are subject to throughout their life, from the cradle to the grave in a capitalist society. If you were to take the education of, shall we say, the people, the Boris Johnsons, or the David Camerons before them, or the George Osbornes and so on, you know, you take their education and you compare it with the education of ordinary people in a local comprehensive school. The main difference, the most important difference, I tell you, is not that at Eton they have bigger classrooms, better teachers, better facilities, superior labs. They have all those things, but that's not the fundamental difference. The fundamental difference is that if you go to Eton, from the moment you set foot, and the, you know, prep school you went to before, you are told by a thousand ways, you're told, you are destined to lead. You are educated to lead and command people. They look for leadership qualities. As you walk down the halls of the college, you will see the former prime ministers who went there, or the former Nobel Prize winners, or whatever. Working class people, on the contrary, are trained and conditioned to follow orders. And it's not just what happens at school, it's how you're treated at work and in every aspect of your life that way. Your job, your circumstances, and so on, are that you are following orders. Now, if that's the fundamental problem, and therefore working class people lack the confidence, then the question comes, if we're talking about workers running society, how do they get that confidence? And here, I think the answer, again, is supplied by history, is you get it through struggle. You get it through mass collective struggle when working class people get a sense of their power, get a sense of what they can do. And when they do that, their horizons widen, they open up to all sorts of ideas, and they can get the idea that they can take over and run things. Now, that could sound like, you know, this is a chicken and egg question. Well, yeah, but how do you struggle if you haven't got the confidence? But the truth is that mass working class struggles don't start to make a revolution or change the sign. They start over something concrete. You can go into Tahrir Square like they did in a million people in Egypt, or you can have a general strike for an aim that seems to you perfectly attainable. Get rid of the dictator Mubarak, or, you know, win this wage increases, or stop these cuts, and so on. And in the process, this should be teased out in the discussion, but in the process, you get a sense of your collective strength. That's why, again, Marx, writing right at the beginning of his political life in 1845, said a revolution is necessary, not just because it's the only way you can overthrow the existing rulers, but also because it is through the process of a revolution that working class people can rid themselves of the muck of ages, he called it. That meant all that conditioning and rotten ideas that were thrust into people's heads. Rid themselves of the muck of ages and fit themselves to make society anew. That's what Marx said over then, and I think it's still true today. It is through mass struggle that people will get the confidence to take control of society. And if they do, as I said at the beginning, I have not the slightest doubt they will make an enormously better job of running it than the present lot of rubbish that we have. Okay, thank you.